Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yalke in Washington. Ahead, an expert shares his thoughts on the destruction of the temple in Palmyra. We continue our conversation on violence among youth.
If the adults would learn how to reboot their own behavior, the next generations of children are going to be a lot less prone to violence.
An analyst looks at what's happening in world stock markets. And from our music department, rumor that One Direction may be going several. It's right here on BOA. As feared, the Islamic State group, which captured the ancient Syrian caravan city of Palmyra in May, has destroyed the nearly 2,000-year-old Roman-era Beit Shaman temple. My colleague Victor Beatty is following the story and joins us now here in the studio. Victor, what's going on?
Hello, Susan. Well, the IS group considers such artifacts that predate Islam as symbols of paganism, although they have sold some to finance their operations. The temple's destruction follows last week's beheading of 83-year-old Khalid al-Assad, who had served as chief of the city's antiquities department for half a century. Trinity University Syria specialist David Lesh in Texas has visited Palmyra, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, many times. He told me the destruction of the temple is a tragedy, but not a surprise to him.
It's not surprising. In fact, I'm surprised it took so long for the Islamic State to blow it up, because it's been their modus operandi to destroy any sort of references to polytheism or pre-Islamic religious belief. So this, unfortunately, is not surprising. You know, it's part of their raison d'etre in terms of making the headlines. If they're not in the headlines for a certain amount of time, they'll do something spectacular, blow up something, or unfortunately behead some people and record it and put it over the social media, and it goes the world over. And for some psychological reason I don't quite understand, it's good for their recruiting. It feeds into the anger of various youth across the world, and they come flocking to this sort of thing.
You've been to Palmyra many times. What is the historical context of this temple? What does this loss represent?
Palmyra was built as a Roman entrepot, a trade way station that reached its height in the 200s CE. And it's one of the great archaeological sites in the world because it was based on Roman architecture. It is essentially a Roman city built in the early years of the Common Era. And yet, since it was in the middle of the desert, the city is basically as it was back then. It's been restored somewhat over the centuries, and particularly by the Syrian government over the last 30, 40 years, as tourism picked up in the country of Syria. But in most cities where there were Roman ruins, there were cities built on top of that, and they usually destroyed many of the Roman ruins to build the new cities, to build the new buildings. They used the stones, they broke them down. Even in Rome itself, it happened quite frequently. Palmyra is one of the few and only examples where it was not broken down, because a new city really wasn't built on top of it. And so when you arrive at Palmyra, the most spectacular sight is that you see the whole city planning. You see the whole city as it was back then, essentially in terms of how it looked, you know, the main streets, the markets, the houses, and so forth. Even though the buildings themselves, for the most part, are obviously in ruined state, but as far as the whole city architecture and planning, it is as it was 2,000 years ago. And if they destroy much more, and unfortunately I suspect they probably will at some point, it would be just such a tremendous loss, archaeologically speaking.
As tragic as the destruction in Palmyra is, Lesh says, ending the four-year conflict in Syria remains the top priority.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
Thank you, Susan.
Every day, the huge migrations from both North Africa and the Middle East are streaming toward Europe, which has to decide how best to deal with this massive human wave. International Edition's Jeffrey Young has been focusing this week on the migration crisis, interviewing top people who have ideas and possibly solutions. and he's here with me in the studio. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me on International Edition. Today I spoke with Joost Hiltemann, who is based in Brussels as the program director for the Middle East and North Africa for the International Crisis Group. He says that so far, Europe has not really come up with a solid, unified approach for dealing with this migration crisis.
Clearly, the European Union is in a total panic, and partly because refugees landing on its shores, which it prefers to call migrants, and secondly, because the European Union is internally terribly divided, with some countries taking certain steps and other countries trying other steps. So there is no coordination, and therefore no effective response to the crisis.
These people need shelter, they need sanitation, they need security, they need protection, they need so many different things. How do we rectify this? Is there a fair way?
Well, there must be a fair way. I'm not sure that's the one that will be pursued. Obviously, there is the possibility to accommodate these people, but there are two ways. One is to actually accommodate them and to try to resettle them, and I suspect that many will end up in temporary camps where treatment will be very bad and where there will be selection of those who are seen as genuine refugees as opposed to migrants. And then, you know, what we've seen in the past is a deportation policy in some cases to places in the Middle East and elsewhere that are deemed not dangerous because of armed conflict. The other one is to actually, for the European Union and the member states, to have a forward-looking policy toward doing something about the crisis in the Middle East that give rise to these refugee streams in the first place. And that is a very difficult and long-term challenge, but I haven't even seen the first steps toward it. All I've seen is more bombing of the Islamic State targets, but not really a political strategy about stemming these conflicts and trying to get political dialogue started in these countries between the various warring parties.
One of the publications, the Huffington Post, proposed a solution that Europe could use to try to convince countries in the path on the way to Europe to absorb more of these refugees, such as the Balkan states, etc. How realistic is it?
Well, I mean, this is actually standing policy already. It has always been European approach to the refugee crisis in the past that you keep refugees or keep people in the countries, don't let them become refugees in the first place. Then if they become and when they become refugees, keep them in the host countries that are still can serve as a buffer between the conflict countries and European states. So let it be Turkey, let it be Jordan or Lebanon, which has over 1 million Syrian refugees out of a total population of Lebanese citizens of 4 million, and then 500,000 of Palestinian refugees from earlier flows from Palestine. So that is a huge, huge burden that is going to burst at some point, of course, and that is why, in fact, we see so many people now flowing from these countries.
That was Joost Hiltemann, the Brussels-based program director for the Middle East and North Africa for the International Crisis Group.
There seems like there's so many people with so many needs.
That's why International Edition and VOA will continue to stay on top of this huge story, Susan.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
One way you can learn more about the migrant and refugee crisis in Europe is by going to Facebook and doing a search for the hashtag Migrant Lives Matter. Michael Lippin has been looking into that for us and joins us. Hey, Michael, what did you find?
Hi, Susan. I did do a search for that Facebook hashtag a short time ago, and I found a post by the International Organization for Migration. The post includes 6 photos of migrants who have been camped out at a settlement several kilometers from the French port of Calais. That's where thousands of migrants have been gathering in recent weeks as they try to cross into England through the tunnel under the English Channel. But the photos posted by IOM don't show the faces of the migrants, and that's meant to make a point. IOM says that most of the migrants living in that makeshift camp near Calais actually fear the photographer's lenses for different reasons. It says some of them worry that their family members and friends might suffer retaliation in their home country if certain people find out that they are in Europe. IOM says other migrants don't want their families to see the poor living conditions in which they find themselves and would rather lie to their relatives by saying that they're staying at good hotels, for example.
And what else have you found on Facebook?
Well, a really powerful video report by Britain's Channel 4 News and its reporter Lindsay Hilsum. Hilsum reported from the border of Greece and Macedonia about the plight of thousands of people trying to enter Macedonia from Greece, where many of them had arrived by boat. Many of those people said they were refugees from the Syrian civil war, fleeing attacks by the forces of Syrian President Assad and the Islamic State militant group. Hilsum's report has heartbreaking scenes. You can see Macedonian security forces struggling to control the flow of migrants, using batons and stun grenades against some of them, and, you know, traumatizing the women and children in the process. Hilsum's report was posted on Sunday, and it's had more than 625,000 views so far. And the Syrians that she spoke to in that story just have a simple message for her. They say they want to live. Susan?
Yes, that's heartbreaking. Well, thank you very much, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
No need to worry that an asteroid will destroy the Earth in September. The internet has been abuzz recently with a viral rumor that life on Earth will be wiped out by a massive asteroid sometime near the end of September. The folks at NASA beg to differ and have had to come out with a statement they hope will defuse this rumor of doom. Paul Trottis, manager of NASA's Near Earth Object Office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, says that there is not one shred of scientific evidence that an asteroid or any other celestial object will hit the Earth on those dates. NASA says that they haven't seen any asteroids or comets that would smack into the Earth in the foreseeable future. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Stocks in China led another slump in Asian markets today, but stocks are rebounding in other parts of the world. Joining us to discuss the situation is economic analyst David Peltier of TheStreet.com. Welcome, David. I'm glad to have you on the show today.
Great. My pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you. So why is the market doing so well in the U.S. after Monday's huge drop?
Well, if anything, there's two reasons. The main reason, futures were already pointing to a higher open even before we went to bed last night. And that was because you expect to see some bit of a snapback rally. It is one of the steepest declines over a three-day period, really, that's ever been measured in history. But that was accelerated about 2 hours before the markets opened up New York time when interest rates were cut in China. China really has been driving a lot of what's been happening in Europe and in the U.S., because China's really been responsible for most of the growth in a lot of these multinational companies, even including Apple. You saw what happened to Apple, the largest company in the world, when it was believed that China was slowing down.
Is there anything that you would like to see the government do to help the stock market, or should they mind their own business?
I'm in the latter camp. I believe they should mind their own business to the extent that the government, really the Fed, anyone, very few people can really control what's going to happen with stock prices going forward. There are different monetary policies we can enact to either speed up or try to slow down growth in this country. And if that has an effect on the stock market, so be it. But direct intervention in the stock market, and we're seeing what good that's doing in China right now, where they really can have direct intervention in the stock market, it really doesn't help in the long run. To answer your question, yes, I'd rather see them mind their own business. I don't think things are so bad in the U.S. right now that it would even require that, where people argued in 2008, 2009, people were asking for more of a direct hand from the government.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today, David.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, what can be done about youth violence? And is One Direction losing its direction? Yesterday, we spoke with author Jan Arnaud about violence among youth, and today we continue our conversation. Jan, basically it seems like if the adults would behave properly, their children are more likely to behave properly. But this is sort of a catch-22 situation because these adults are behaving badly because maybe they witnessed violence as a child.
Exactly.
And so parents and adults, and of course all adults, raise children even if they don't have their own, because almost every economic decision we make has an impact on children. But if the adults would learn how to reboot their own behavior, the next generations of children are going to be a lot less prone to violence.
What can society as a whole do here?
Society as a whole, first of all, can make sure that they teach their children empathy, not sympathy. Sympathy is kind of an outside-the-ring attitude, but empathy is where you actually feel something that the other person is experiencing. Teaching the child empathy by your own actions, showing empathy, is very, very big. So, for example, that translates into the playground, where if a child is being bullying and you have empathy for that child, or even for the bully, you're able to do something about it even as a child. So showing empathy is a big thing. Being there for your children, being in your child's life as opposed to on the outskirts of your children's lives, is very, very important. So showing up is a big deal. Not abdicating your responsibility as a parent to the television and to the computer and the video game. Speaking of computers, it's really good to have the computer, the family computer, in the family room or the kitchen so you can monitor what your children are doing. Knowing who your children's friends are is very important. And putting your foot down about not fraternizing with certain children if you feel that their influence is bad for your child. Also, keeping the lines of communication open, very, very important. So many kids today don't want to have anything to do with their parents. They will not speak with their parents. They will not divulge information. I have over 400 things in my book, 400 very easy-to-do solutions that all cost nothing, that parents, caregivers, and other people who are in the lives of children can do to help alleviate this problem of violence that we, by the way, have created for our children. We should stop blaming the victims, that's another thing, and start looking at ourselves to see what we have created for them.
And this is something people can get from your book. And the name of that book again?
It's called In the Line of Fire, Raising Kids in a Violent World.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us today, Jan. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
How is this related to this? Both coffee and these birds come from the same tropical regions. But Robert Rice of the Smithsonian's Migratory Bird Center says growing conventional sun-grown coffee can change that lush tropical landscape because it doesn't provide much in the way of habitat or biodiversity. Shade-grown coffee, on the other hand, helps preserve the environment.
Some of the birds that are frequenting and making use of shade-grown coffee are this group called wood warblers.
So the Migratory Bird Center developed a bird-friendly certification.
Any of the major organic certification agencies have someone who has been trained by us to evaluate the shade.
Bird-friendly coffee now extends to more than 5,500 hectares, including where coffee first originated.
The shade actually in Ethiopia is great. Almost any coffee in Ethiopia is going to qualify as bird-friendly.
So coffee is for the birds. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Rumor has it that the boy band One Direction is not going to be going in one direction for very much longer. Our music man, Larry London, is here to dish the dirt with us. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you, Susan.
So what's going on with this teen sensation?
Well, I'll tell you, this is creating quite a buzz on the internet right now. People, E! Online, the London Sun, have all reported that One Direction will take an extended hiatus. Now, the media have been reaching out to the band spokesperson, and so far there's been no official comment from the spokesperson. However, the members of the band are now tweeting their thoughts and feelings in response to all of the fans that they're hearing from who are concerned and scared and upset and depressed over...
What are they tweeting? Are
well,
they
here's
we're
what
not
they're
going?
Saying. I'm glad you asked me. Niall Horan tweeted, "We are not splitting up." Lewis Tomlinson tweeted, "It's just a break. Promise." And Liam Payne tweeted, "There's so much more to come." So from what the guys are saying, it sounds like this is going to be exactly what they've said it is, an extended hiatus.
Meanwhile, they're getting a lot of free publicity. Now, this group was kind of created by hand, right?
Yes. Simon Cowell, who is a producer, a record executive, and a judge on the very popular X Factor TV show in the UK. He put this group together. It was a combination of artists who had auditioned as solo artists, but weren't quite good enough to go on as a solo artist. So he then formed the group and called it One Direction, and they've gone on to sell over 65 million records
wow.
around the world.
Wow. Yeah. What are some of the big tunes they've had?
The big tunes. Out of the 15 singles that they've released so far since 2010, their first big hit, which went to number one in the UK in 2011, was called What Makes You Beautiful. And since then, they've had success with Little Things in 2012, and a year later, it was the best song ever and Story of My Life. And their latest single is called Drag Me Down. It sold 500,000 copies its very first week. They just put out the new video for it last week, and it's off of the upcoming fifth album. Now, One Direction are the very first band in the United States to have four consecutive number one albums.
Wow, that's impressive.
Very impressive.
And why do girls love them so much?
Because they're good looking.
Because they're cute.
That's it. That's what it comes down to. They're good looking. They dance. They present well. And you know, so far you got to love them because they're putting out great music.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you.
I've got fire for a heart. I'm not scared of the dark. You've never seen it look so easy. I got a river for a soul, and baby, you're a boat. Baby, you're my only reason. If I didn't have you, there would be nothing left. The shell of a man that could never be his best. If I didn't have you, I'd never see the sun. You taught me how to be someone, yeah. All my life, you stood by me when no one else was ever behind me. All these lights, they can't blind me. With your love, nobody can drag me. All my life, you stood by me.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy the music.
Nobody can drag me down. I got fire for a heart. I'm not scared of the dark. You've never seen it look so easy. I got a river for a soul. And baby, you're a boat. Baby, you're my own.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
70 years ago this month, the victors of the Second World War, horrified by crimes committed by the Nazi regime, issued a decree for the prosecution of three crimes: crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The decree, now known as the Nuremberg or London Charter, established that perpetrators of murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhumane acts committed against the civilian population before or during the war could not hide behind their official position in government, nor their obedience to orders from above, to avoid criminal responsibility for participating in such horrendous acts. Since then, these principles have served as the basis for successive provisions on war crimes and crimes against humanity in the statutes of international hybrid and domestic tribunals that have charged and prosecuted hundreds of individuals, from the foot soldier all the way up to the head of state, for such crimes. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia indicted 161 people for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide committed during the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. Including former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic and other political and military leaders. Similarly, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda indicted 93 individuals accused of being responsible for the 1994 Rwandan genocide, including dozens of political and military officials. And in Sierra Leone, a special hybrid court convicted, among others, former Liberian President Charles Taylor for his role in aiding, abetting, and planning atrocities committed by rebels in the civil war there. At one point, these individuals may have believed that they would never have to answer for their crimes. They might have felt justified when perpetrating atrocities because their actions were part either of government policy or of a wide practice that was tolerated or condoned by the government. But no one is above the law. From sexual violence in eastern Congo to the brutal torture in the Assad regime's prisons in Syria, we will continue to seek accountability for the world's worst crimes, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of the London Charter. Such accountability is a stabilizing force in international affairs, and it is what our values and the memory of the victims demand.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. The following